As counsel are getting situated, I'll welcome you to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. My name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding today, and it's my pleasure to serve with Chief Judge Cleary and Judge Larkin. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant, of course, will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. When you begin your comments, give us your name and the party you represent so that we've got that for the recording. Whenever you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Steve Meshbesher, and I represent the petitioner, the appellant. This case is more simple than your last case. This is a person who prejudicially relied on a legally inaccurate implied consent advisory. He had a motorcycle accident. The officer was at the scene. He was taken by ambulance to a hospital. The officer went to the hospital and told him that if he refused to take a test, it would be a crime. He testified at the implied consent hearing that he would take the test, even though no warrant was applied for, no effort was made to get a warrant, telephonically or physically, and he said, the reason I took it, because I was afraid I'd be committing a crime. I went along with the officer because I was afraid I would commit a crime if I didn't. That's the prejudice. Under Johnson, he's entitled to rescission of the license revocation. The Johnson test falls under McDonnell, where the Minnesota Supreme Court outlined a three-prong approach. The first prong, one, is license revoked, submitted to a breath, blood, or urine test. We know that. That's not an issue. Two, the person prejudicially relied on the implied consent advisory in deciding to undergo testing. Well, he testified. I took it because I was afraid I was going to be committing a crime, because that's what the officer told him. And he wanted to do whatever the officer told him. And three, the implied consent advisory did not accurately inform the person of the legal consequence of refusing to take a test. And that's true. He read him an advisory that has been since declared wrong. He told them, if you don't take it, you're going to commit a crime. He didn't say what kind of crime it was. My client was laying in a hospital bed, and he went along with the officer, as his testimony states, because he was afraid of not going with the officer and doing what the officer asked him to do. He submitted to a blood test. No one disputes that. He relied on the implied consent advisory as it was read to him.
That's what he said.
Yeah, he testified to that.
Right. The district court made a finding in its memorandum.
Yeah, and the district court's wrong.
Just a minute. The petitioner has failed to establish that he prejudicially relied on the implied consent advisory when he agreed to take the test. Isn't that a finding of fact rejecting your client's testimony?
No. He didn't say that. What the judge did is he made an error, and I'm at the appellate level asking you to correct that error. He did not make a credibility finding. He did not say my client was lying. He did not say that he didn't believe my client. That comment that the trial court made is wrong. That's why we're appealing it, to correct that error. I know what the district court said. I know what you're reading.
Yeah, he had the burden to prove the thing, And the district court says he failed to establish that. It sounds like the district court is saying he didn't carry his burden of proof.
Well, he did. That's the problem. That's where
the district court says he didn't, and is the district court's the one who makes credibility determinations?
Well, he didn't say that. If we had not put the petitioner on the stand, you can attack it by saying we didn't present any evidence.
Absolutely. That's
if we had but we put him on the stand, and the judge never said, "I don't believe you." He never said, there's a credibility issue. He never said, I think you're not telling the truth. He never said that. That comment that you're referring to, I've read that too, is wrong, and that's why we're on appeal. And what the appellate court does is correct errors. And I'm asking the court to correct that error, because the judge at the trial court level made an error, a big one.
Well, I agree. The reasoning that precedes that is not stellar. I agree with that. But it seems like the conclusion is one of whether your client carried his burden of proof.
Well, he did. The problem is the trial court doesn't say the facts to support his conclusion. There are no facts. The facts that were supported at the trial court show he did produce evidence.
He produced it.
Yeah, and the judge never disputed the production. He didn't say, well, wait a second here. I don't believe you. I don't think you're telling the truth. I think we have a credibility problem. I heard your testimony. I don't believe it.
So is your argument that absent that express statement, the district court cannot say that a party did not carry their burden of proof?
In this case, he carried the burden of proof. In this case, his sworn testimony, when he got on the stand and testified under oath, that he only took it because he was afraid not to take it based upon what the officer read him, is the evidence in this case. What you just read is an error of law, and the trial court made that error of law, and I'm on appeal for you to correct that error. The trial court didn't understand that. The trial court never said, well, wait a second here. Let's stop this right now. You testified, and you know what? I don't believe your testimony. I watched you testify. I looked at your face. I have decided, based upon what I see and what I hear, you're not telling me the truth. And then we've got a problem. But he didn't say that. In his order that you make reference to, he didn't say that because it wasn't there.
So it is your argument that absent an express finding on credibility, this is a legal error?
This is a big legal error. The judge made a big one.
What would be the syllabus point to stand for that proposition?
Truth. How about looking at somebody?
How would we put that in a published opinion? That if the district court does not make an express credibility finding, then on appeal we're going to accept the testimony of the witness?
But he didn't do that. And if you want to write an opinion, a published opinion, the trial court said something that's not based upon the truth. There's no evidence to support it. That's why we have something in the court system called evidence. That's why we have the balance of evidence. The trial court is supposed to look at something and listen to it and make a determination of what that evidence means, and he did not do that. He disregarded the evidence. And he made a conclusion disregarding the evidence. He was wrong. I've appealed it, not because I have anything personal against the trial court. I appealed it because he's just wrong on the facts. Now, however you want to word it on the appellate level is up to you three. I'm not going to write this opinion. You are. But he was just dead wrong on the facts. And he just disregarded the law. We know what the law is because you've already interpreted it at the appellate court. The Supreme Court has already interpreted it at the Supreme Court. So the law is pretty clear. He made a finding of fact there's no evidence to support it. That's why I'm here. I'm asking you to clarify and correct his mistake. And the only way to do that is reverse his decision and rescind the revocation. So that's why I'm here. I know exactly what you're looking at. I've read it several times, and I was very bothered by that. And I advised my client that you should appeal this because you have the power to correct that mistake. And clearly, it's a mistake. He made a decision. I didn't. He wrote the decision not based upon the testimony in the courtroom. I was in the courtroom. He didn't ask any questions. He made a decision. I didn't know where that decision came from. Wasn't the evidence.
How does one establish prejudicial reliance? What does that mean to prejudicially rely in this context?
In this case, my client testified. He said that I took the test because I was afraid I would do something wrong. The officer told me if I didn't take the test, I'd be committing a crime.
How does that compare to driver Moser in the McDonald case?
This is more on point because he testified, and he testified that he was afraid that he'd be committing a crime. He didn't know what kind of crime that was. He didn't know how serious it would be because the officer never described it to him. He just said, I'm laying on a hospital bed. He tells me I'm going to commit a crime, and I want to do whatever he wants me to do so I don't. Now, when you acquiesce to an officer laying on a hospital bed, when he tells you you're going to be committing a crime if you don't do what he tells you to do, and he reads something to you that's clearly legally erroneous, that's prejudice. He took the test because he says that guy was leaning over me when I was laying on a hospital bed, told me something, and I relied upon what he said to me, and I reacted to what he did because I was afraid of him. I was afraid of his power. He had a uniform and a badge and a gun, and he told me if I didn't take this test, I'd be committing a crime. He said, whoa, whoa, he testified. I don't want to commit a crime. So I will do whatever you want me to do. What do you want me to do? So he took a blood test without a warrant. The officer said, I could have gotten a warrant. I know how to get one. I could call dispatch and get some assistance from another officer. I could go telephonically. I could have got a search warrant another way. He knows all the remedies to get a search warrant, but he didn't care to use those. And in this case, the petitioner testified. He testified under oath. He was cross-examined. I direct examined him.
Is the finding regarding prejudicial reliance, is that a finding of fact?
It is by the judge at the trial court level, and he's wrong.
So we review that for clear error.
Clear error. Trial court made clear error. And all due respect to the trial court. He made a decision, and he just pulled out the facts out of the air. I don't know where he came up with those facts, because it sure doesn't show it on the transcript.
Well, those facts seem to relate, in my view, to an analysis of whether or not consent to testing was coerced. Those seem to sort of track the things we look at when we're deciding whether there was a Fourth Amendment consent exception to a warrantless search. Like maybe the district court judge confused the two issues.
I'm going on the case law.
I understand that. I'm just trying to understand the district court's reasoning. It looks to me that
he had no reasoning.
Was thinking about consent, totality of the circumstances. Did a person understand? Was there coercion? How long did it take? But those things don't apply when you're doing a McDonald analysis.
And that's why I appealed it, because there is no reasoning. He didn't give a reasoning. He made a statement that has no reasoning to it. It has no facts to support it. I don't like coming to the appellate court unless I have something to support my argument. I've been here a lot, and you probably know that. That's not my motive. I'm here because I could not, for the life of me, figure out what he decided and how he came to that conclusion, because there's no facts to support it. Thank you. Anyone have any questions?
It appears we have none. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. William Young, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the respondent commissioner, and may it please counsel as well. Judge Rodenberg, I believe your question hit the nail on the head, which is that this is a factual determination made by the district court, which is reviewed by this court to be whether it's clearly erroneous or not. Here we have record evidence that the district court noted that the appellant had sort of selective memory as to which parts of the advisory he read. He sort of only remembered exactly the moment in the advisory that told him that refusal is a crime, but he didn't have any really recollections of the rest of it. And I think the court implicitly rejected this testimony.
Lest you think that I've made up my mind, I haven't. The reasoning that precedes that finding does leave something to be desired, because the district court seems to have emphasized that the implied consent advisory was read word for word. That doesn't seem to help your cause. That the petitioner did not appear confused and was alert and responded to his questions. That doesn't seem to help your cause. The petitioner indicated he understood the implied consent advisory, the one that told him the wrong thing. That doesn't seem to help your cause. At the end of which, I agree, it does seem that he said you failed to carry your burden of proof, but the reasoning that precedes that doesn't lead to that conclusion.
I agree that the order does seem to leave some gaps. I think there is some confusion as to how the court reached its ultimately reached its finding that the petitioner did not prejudicially rely upon the advisory. And just to be clear, the commissioner's not arguing that prongs one and three of the McDonald test aren't met. They absolutely were met. The only one here is that second prong about prejudicial reliance. But this court has said in a couple of unpublished decisions after Johnson and Morehouse were issued, Hansen and Sproul, for example, that is a factual determination. And
well, counsel, you know, I have to go back for a minute. We have a warrantless blood test, an inaccurate and misleading advisory, and we have the appellant testifying as to his confusion and the reason why he refused. That, to me, looks like an error of law on the court's part in understanding what is prejudicial impact rather than a credibility determination. So if that's true, do you lose?
Maybe I'm not sure I'm understanding your question.
I'm trying to figure out why we're here, honestly. It seems to me that this judge made a blatant mistake here. I don't know why, but I don't find that a credibility determination. I find that a mistake of law, that once the clients testified that he took the test, they didn't take the test, they misled by the advisory, that constitutes prejudicial reliance. I don't know what else does, so I'm not sure why we're here. I mean, the court made an error of law, it seems to me.
Well, and I would harken back to Judge Larkin's question of opposing counsel about what needs to be established to show prejudicial reliance.
Well, the Supreme Court in McDonald said the driver would have refused to submit to testing had she not felt certain that criminal penalties would result. It therefore appears that her interests were prejudiced when law enforcement officials misinformed her as to her potential criminal liability. I mean, that seems to tell us that what the Supreme Court thinks when it says prejudicial reliance under McDonald is that the person submitted to testing because he or she relied on misinformation. And here we have a fellow testifying, I was scared, I was told I was going to be charged with a crime, I did whatever he wanted me to do because I didn't want to be charged with a crime. How was that any different than McDonald? How is that any different than the finding in McDonald that the person wouldn't have taken the crime had the person not been misinformed? It seems like that's exactly what we have here. I can't begin to understand how the district court judge takes that test, applies it to this testimony, and says he didn't prove prejudicial reliance.
Based upon the testimony that was offered by Mr. Schneider in this case, his testimony is very similar to that Moser testimony that's referenced here. I think the step that is lacking is that the district court heard the testimony, it was there, and it seemed to implicitly reject it. And this court has affirmed cases in which the district court has.
We do defer to credibility, and we do say the district court implicitly rejected. But in those cases, I can look at the record and see why that happened. There's some support for it. I'm not finding anything in his testimony that provides a basis to reject his claim that he only submitted to testing because he was threatened with criminal charges and he didn't want to be charged with a crime. I mean, I get that the district court said, well, here are some other reasons why his testimony is not credible, but those reasons don't go to his testimony that he submitted to avoid a criminal charge. I mean, quite frankly, the reasons that the district court gave, as Judge Rodenberg said, help his case. The fact that he understood what he was told and acted to avoid the consequence that he was told tend to support prejudicial reliance rather than refute it.
The portion of petitioner's testimony or Mr. Schneider's testimony, I think it's the selective memory of what happened. Granted, it was several years earlier and he'd had this accident, but the courts, there was the record evidence that reflected that he didn't.
So what you're telling me is you honestly think what this district court reasoned was, I don't believe you when you're telling me you only took this test because you were afraid of being charged with a crime?
The district court's order leaves gaps that if it was filled in more thoroughly, I think we'd have a much better understanding of what the court's reasoning was. The testimony seemed to reflect that Mr. Schneider only remembered the process to the extent that he remembered exactly the part that would help him to testify about prejudicial reliance, but conveniently had forgotten everything else. And I think the court sort of picked up upon that and seemed to think that I'm not finding this credible. I don't think this is what was happening at the time Mr. Schneider was read the advisory. This seems to be an after-the-fact justification to try to now go through the McDonald test as clarified by Johnson and Morehouse. I think that's the way the court seemed to have interpreted the testimony because
the court faulted him for presenting the evidence the Supreme Court told him he had to present to prevail on a due process claim.
In a way that the court didn't find credible. I realize it's very circular. I understand the roadblock here.
We don't mean to give you a hard time, Mr. Young. You're stuck with these facts, so keep arguing.
I really don't have a whole lot to add. I think we've kind of hit the nail on the head here. It's really looking at that second factor. It's a clearly erroneous standard for finding a fact. This court has labeled it a finding of fact multiple times. Yes, we don't have the most artfully written order, but based upon the record, I think there can be the implicit finding that the court just rejected the testimony as not credible. If there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
It appears there are none. Mr. Messpresher, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use
that
time.
May it please the court, I'm going to end by referring the court to page 41 of the transcript from the implied consent hearing. On direct examination, under oath, he told the court in a question asked by me, he told me at the bottom on item number 21, he told me that if I didn't take the test, that it was a crime. I didn't know what the crime was. All I knew is that I was scared and I took whatever he wanted me to do. I didn't want to get in trouble. Next question, 25. Do you recall him telling you that if the test was unreasonably delayed or if you refused to make a decision, you will be considered to have refused the test? In other words, answer. Yeah, I remember him explaining that I had to do it, otherwise it was a crime. More importantly, if you go to page 41, this is a cross-examination by the state, where the state attorney general asked a question on item 5, line 5.
Are you on 41 now?
I'm on page 44 now.
Page 44, okay, because 41 was your test.
Yes, now I'm going to the cross-examination by the state.
Got it.
If you look at line 7, or actually line 5. So you only remember parts of the implied consent advisory. That's what the state's arguing today. The answer on line 7, I remember him, Mr. Book, coming into the room at the hospital and telling me that he was taking my blood, and I didn't really know what was going on. And then I remember him telling me that if I didn't do it, it was a crime. And then I didn't want I just did whatever he wanted me to do because they don't want to break the law. On line number 17, he says he didn't remember some stuff, but I do remember him saying that if I don't do this, that I was in trouble. That's basically what I remember. Thank you. Nothing further.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We'll issue a decision within 90 days.
Thank you.
We're actually a little bit ahead of schedule.